Deutsche Welle, Living Planet. From DW Studios in Bonn, this is Living Planet, and I'm Charlotta Lomas. Coming up on today's show, we revisit some of our favourite environment stories from 2016. And we've selected a rather musical collection. Our first report has the makings of one of those cult stories that will be a favourite forever and ever. Take a remote misty mountain range known as the Sky Islands. Birds that have been cut off from their fellows and doing their own thing for about 5 million years. A robin who is not a bird but is very fond of them. And a Twitter encounter with some incredible music. Intrigued? Well, our reporter Shavi Sashdev tracked down a conservationist who is using unusual methods to help preserve some very special birds.
In the Sky Islands of India's western mountain range, the Ghats, ecologist V.V. Robin is studying the impact of isolation on the language of birds. Over the last 15 years, Robin, yes, that's his real name, has learned that the birds in these mountains landed here millions of years ago and somehow stayed behind. Isolated on their own mountaintops, their genetic makeup has diverged quite fast. Remarkably, their songs have diverged even more.
Some of these birds at least came in from the Himalayas when there was forest connected all through from the Himalayas down to Western Ghats. And then they kind of got isolated up on the mountaintops as the climate changed and the wetter forests kind of moved up the mountaintop. These birds moved up with them and then basically they got stuck. The birds got here about 8-9 million years back. They've been isolated on some of the mountains. They haven't crossed some of the deep gaps, the valleys and the mountains in Western Ghats for about 5 million years.
But they're birds. Surely they can just fly away and visit their relatives and friends in other places?
Exactly. That's what one would think. But what happens is that there are some birds which are highly specialized and they live only on the tops, only on the mountain tops. And these are these understory birds, which means that they don't really fly up into the canopy, you know, the tops of the trees. They live on the forest floor. So their environment is really this dark rainforest habitat, but the ones that are stuck on the mountains. So they are very shy of crossing the rainforest boundaries usually. They have small wings, they're small birds. And even when they disperse, they don't move very far.
This isolation is why the habitat is called the Sky Islands. The birds never come down below an altitude of 1,300 meters. Robin has found that the further apart these mountaintop islands are, the more the songs vary. Think of how residents of neighboring states or countries share more words in common. For instance, in Europe, the region of Orava straddles Poland and the Czech Republic. There's a lot of overlap in vocabulary. But Poles and Austrians, separated by a whole country, have a harder time understanding each other. In India, it would be comparable to how people in the northeast states of Bengal and Orissa speak separate languages, but they share many cognates. A person from the south, though, say from Tamil Nadu, wouldn't understand either a Bengali or an Oriya. The same way, birds separated by valleys have different songs. Now, this didn't surprise Robin. What did surprise him was that even recent isolation caused by human encroachment on a single mountain resulted in song variation.
If birds are not being interacting with each other because of predominantly our habitat modifications, then the songs tend to diverge. That we thought was quite interesting. But this scale of differentiation was kind of fairly low. This is the kind of, the Orissa and Bengal divide where they can understand each other, but they are not probably going to respond very strongly.
In cities, the cawing crows and chirping sparrows we hear are not singing. They're calling. They're sharing warnings and alerts about food and danger. Songbirds use songs for specific communication, especially mating. Only males sing, and only to impress the females. Here in the tranquil Sky Islands, the songs are totally unique because while there are crows and sparrows here, the Nilgiri pipit, the white-bellied shotwing, the laughing thrushes are indigenous to the Western Ghats. These birds and their songs are found nowhere else in the world. In fact, the pipit is endangered and lives only on two mountaintops. The population is dwindling because human plantation has lost it 85% of its grassland habitat. Robin found that people in the region didn't even recognize these birds, let alone their songs. He realized that working in an academic silo wasn't going to help them, and though they're not critically endangered yet, he didn't want to wait until it was too late. On Twitter, he learned about American musician Ben Mirren. Ben beatboxes. He makes percussion sounds with his lips and tongue, loops them with a recorder, and then uses parts of the bird song to punctuate it, like this. Robin invited Ben to India, and soon they'd created not just songs featuring the birds' melodies, but also workshops to engage students. They invited teenagers to Robin's institute and taught the kids to identify these local birds and sample bird songs and make their own tunes. Through this interactive beatboxing session, they've inspired a new generation to pay attention to these birds and their role in the local ecology.
Some of the teachers actually wrote back to us and said that these students have started going around recording songs on their mobile phones and they're trying to make music with it and so on. Yeah, and many actually started taking photos of some of the birds around them and started sending it to us. So I think in some ways it's working.
For now, Robin is focusing on mapping the diverging songs of several birds across these geographies. And through the bird beatboxing, though he can't bring the birds down from the mountains, he hopes at least to bring their songs down to us. Chavi Sachdev for DW in Mumbai, India.
Environmental research is often interpreted by scientists through complicated graphs, charts, and scatter plots. But what if there was another way to communicate this scientific data? Well, we're about to meet two scientists who found a way. The story starts with ecologist Lauren Oakes. Now, she spent 6 years researching yellow cedar trees in the Alexander Archipelago, a long sweep of islands off the coast of Alaska. And she found that these fine-grained, butter-coloured wood trees, which can live for more than 1,000 years, are dying off because of climate change. She shared her data with Nick Sarve, a fellow Stanford PhD who experiments with data sonification. The two scientists decided to turn Lauren's data into music. I reached Lauren Oakes and Nick Sarve by phone in California to find out how you turn a yellow cedar tree into a piano solo.
I'm Nick Sarve. I'm a researcher at Stanford University looking at how people make environmental decisions using brain imaging.
Hi, I'm Lauren Oakes. I'm an ecologist and human natural systems scientist, so I study climate change impacts to forest ecosystems and how people adapt to environmental changes. So I work in the West Chichikov Yacobi Wilderness and in a place called Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve, which are in some of the most remote wilderness lands in the United States, and the Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve is one of the largest protected areas in the world, actually. And this place is a remote outer coast. You know, there are fishing boats that go by now and then, but for the most part, I was working alone with my field crew for 2 summers. It's a you know, a rainy ecosystem. You get sudden weather fronts that come in and big swells. And we worked during what was really the prime weather season to do that kind of work in June, July, and August. But that still means, you know, sopping wet, soaking through Gore-Tex and wearing rubber boots, and pretty challenging ecosystem to spend time in, but also beautiful in many ways. It's, I say that it's a landscape of many shades of gray and green, and I definitely learned to love that about it too.
So in a lot of data sonification, you work on data that has an inherent time dimension, where people maybe have visited the same place multiple times, or they're recording data continuously. And so a challenge with Lauren's data was there's not quite that inherent time dimension in terms of returning to the same place multiple times. But what was interesting about it was that the further south you go, the longer climate change has been affecting those forests. And so that was a way to move the piece through time. So you actually, as you're hearing the piece, you're moving from north to south through all the places that Lauren had visited. So going down the coastline, and that's why you hear more dramatic effects as you move through the piece, and you start out with the yellow cedar doing really well. So in a way, it all boils down to numbers, right? I mean, things like the height of the tree and the populations and how well they're doing, those are all things that Lauren painstakingly went through and cataloged for every tree, for every location that she was there. And so it's really just about thinking what aspects of notes, what aspects of music map onto those different variables about the different trees in the forest. And so the way that piece is built is basically every different tree species plays a different instrument. Every note that you hear is an individual tree. The height of the tree is its pitch. The duration of the note has to do with the population of that tree in that particular area and how well that tree is doing. How hard those notes are hit is based on the size of the tree at the base. And then one where we just solo out the yellow cedar so that it's a lot more obvious what's going on there and what the story is. It's being represented by the piano.
In the beginning, you hear, you know, the piano and the many, like a concert of what's a healthy forest of lots of different sizes of trees and different species.
And about halfway through the piece, it really drops off and becomes more sporadic in the notes that are playing.
So kind of a process where younger species are trying to regenerate, so it's a little more busy.
And that's largely due to the fact that, you know, every note is a tree, but if Lauren cataloged a dead tree, I give it its own space in the piece, but it's silent. And so the more of the forest that's dead, the more silence you hear from those instruments.
It's more of a story of the impacts of climate change rather than climate change itself, because you're not taking, you know, climate data that's projected over 100, you know, years or a certain period of time. We're looking at the impacts of it.
It's how the trees are responding, right? And so because the only things we hear are aspects of the trees and how they're doing, we can kind of infer the presence of climate change by the status of that forest and how many trees of a given species are still alive, and this impression of a changing forest, and really tracking that the yellow cedar is kind of passing away and declining in that distribution, and you have other trees rising to fill that void. So kind of just a story of change and also of kind of passing away and fading. It's making climate change a lot more tangible to a lot of people.
I think it definitely, yeah, helps raise awareness in that way. And I think I'm always interested in how we uncover, you know, stories of environmental change and then bring them to light. And, you know, publishing as a scientist is one way to do that for a small audience. But really, I think that these stories are pressing and need to be told in other ways.
Scientists Lauren Oakes and Nick Sarve there giving us an insight into how they turned 6 years' worth of data of the impacts of climate change on yellow cedar trees into song.
Hey everybody, this is Bubba Brinkman recording live from New York City.
Bubba Brinkman is a Canadian rapper who writes lit hop or literature hip hop. He's a self-described nerdy rapper who sings about bookish topics from evolution and medicine to climate change. I spoke with Bubba Brinkman on the line in New York about his latest album called A Rap Guide to Climate Chaos. I started off by asking him who his music is targeting.
I'm trying to cast the net as wide as I can in terms of my audience. I'd like to reach some people that don't think climate change is a problem and make them realize that it is and it needs to be addressed. And actually, I did this show off-Broadway in New York for 5 months earlier this year and performed for thousands of people who came to see it. And, you know, I did have people come up to me afterwards and say, I'm convinced. I came to this show thinking there was no problem, and now I realize there's a big problem. So that's definitely a big part of my audience. But then I think a lot of people come to the show or hear, you know, turn on the album, assuming that they're on board. And they're like, yeah, climate change is a problem and I'm dealing with it because I take shorter showers and I ride my bike to work and I change my light bulbs so that they're not incandescent. And you know, part of the message of the album, which is counterintuitive to a lot of people, let's say on the left, who think they're already on board with the solution, is that that's not good enough. That's not even going to come close to solving the problem. And the only way that it can be solved is via sort of mass scale interventions like carbon taxes or cap and trade systems that change the entire economic incentive structure. So I'm advocating for people to be citizens more so than just consumers.
Your mama's carbon footprint is so fat.
That's a song called Battle Lines, and it's kind of like making fun of some of the contentiousness around this and how it's like really combative in the public discourse. So I relate that to like battle rap comparisons, you know, like the mismatches on either side are shocking. It's like Sarah Palin against Stephen Hawking, because I think the level of intellectual discourse can be pretty mismatched.
Your mama's carbon footprint is so fat. How fat is it? It's fatter than a herd of cattle's methane emissions. It's so fat it shows up on NASA's instruments. Your mama's carbon footprint is so fat when it happens, it melts whole glaciers and floods Manhattan. I'm kicking battle raps on climatic facts with consequences for human habitats like Drake and Meek Mill or Jay-Z and Nas, like a high-stakes version of Lil' Kim.
I've kind of created this formula over the years, so each of my records, the Rap Guide albums, is peer-reviewed by experts in the field. So as I'm devising the lyrics, I'm reaching out to scientists and the people who really study this stuff firsthand, and I'm saying, can you look at my lyrics? Can you tell me if there's anything that misconstrues the science, and if there's problems, I'll change it. So I'm soliciting feedback.
Why do you think music's such an effective medium to talk about such big issues like climate change?
Well, I feel like there's a memorability factor. Like, music is designed to be catchy and to get stuck in your head and get you singing along. And, you know, there's a lot of sort of lyrical witticism in there, and punchlines and metaphors and, you know, just ways of thinking about climate change that we would be counterintuitive but are designed to be memorable. So I think, you know, that's just not my music. That's what all music is like. And I think rap music specifically is a storytelling medium, and stories are more memorable than just concepts. So I feel like the tools were already there. It's just that a lot of rap music is telling certain stories, like the stories of the individual rappers, like here's my neighborhood and here's where I come from and here's my aspirations and that kind of stuff. But a lot of it's very sort of strictly autobiographical. And, you know, I do some of that in the album as well, and talk about my background and how that makes me interested in climate change. But then also the question of how do you get to be a suburban, white, middle-class Canadian that's a hip-hop artist rapping about science for the masses. That's kind of like part of my story. And I do make it personal in that kind of way. But I think just music is a medium for connecting with people, I guess, emotionally in a way that maybe a lecture can't do. But this rhythm and the music is my living. When I do it, I get paid. Yeah, it's been a decade since I've had a day job, and I did it my way, like Frank Sinatra. I'm just kicking up a racket. I could be at a university teaching classes, but this is more fun than teaching. Look at the people I'm reaching. Been around the world. I fly to Europe for the weekend. Do a gig in California before I fly to New Zealand. I've got a song called Fossil Fuel Ballers, which is basically about, you know, in hip hop, there's this trope of like a baller is somebody that sort of ostentatiously flaunts their wealth. And in the context of recent human history, Western civilization could be said to be ballin', to be sort of stuntin'. And like Western civilization is a bling-heavy phenomenon, let's say. And fossil fuel is kind of really the driver of that. You know, it drives most of the economic growth. And global stock markets are still hugely tied to the oil price and things like that. So, you know, I'm an example of a fossil fuel baller, but I think so are you, and so are most of your listeners going to be, if their financial stability comes from the benefits of burning fossil fuels, which I think is the case with most people, because 80% of the global economy is driven by fossil fuels right now. And as for carbon emissions, I'm off the charts with it. Fossil fuel is how I got here, both to entertain you and in my career. If you're earning something, well, then you're burning something. Prosperity is driven by internal combustion.
Where are you drawing inspiration from?
Well, I think it's mostly hip-hop. My musical influences are mostly rappers. And all throughout the album, I'm referencing a lot of my favorite rappers. You'll hear scratches and cuts from Jay-Z and Eminem and MC Light. And there's references to KRS-One and Nas and Mobb Deep and De La Soul. And, you know, my musical influences tend to be a little bit old school, like, you know, 90s and 2000s, and not so much to the rappers that are big today. But that's just, you know, I'm in my 30s. That's like the rap that I grew up on.
And what about Mo Carbon, Mo Problems?
Well, that is a paraphrase of a Notorious B.I.G. song called Mo Money, Mo Problems, which was a big hit in the 90s. And, you know, in that chorus, he said, the more money we talk about, the more problems we see. And really, carbon is a driver of climate change. It's the main driver of climate change, because both methane and CFCs and CO2, those are all sort of carbon-based greenhouse gases. And so carbon in the atmosphere is the summary problem that we have to overcome. And the more of it we have in the atmosphere, the more problems we end up with on Earth.
More problems. More carbon, more problems. Biggie Smalls could get a party popping.
One song out of your entire album, which is your favorite and why?
Well, I think I would have to say the song Carbon Bubble, because Carbon Bubble is fun, bouncy. It's actually really a dance song. It's got a bit of like a Lily Allen or Amy Winehouse kind of flavor to it. I got an amazing soul singer named Mariella based here in New York to do the hook. And it's actually all about carbon finance models and how you can think of the carbon bubble concept as sort of like the subprime mortgage bubble of 2008 and how it crashed the global economy and potentially our reliance on fossil fuel and valuing the the fossil fuel reserves as part of a company's stock is actually a huge mistake financially and irresponsible, because if we really have to keep all that fossil fuel in the ground, then those companies are worth a lot less than what we think, and so are the economies based on those companies' values. So, you know, it's a sort of very nerdy, like policy wonk analysis of cap and trade versus carbon taxes versus business as usual from a financial perspective, but it's actually super fun, bouncy dance song, and it's got some great like saxophone and horn lines in it, and it's about as much like musical whimsy as you could imagine mixing with as much policy complexity in the form of one song, and that's really what I'm all about.
I'm a businessman. I need a carbon price to handle my business. Damn.
What do you want your listeners to take away from your music?
Well, I don't know if I want them to be entirely persuaded and indoctrinated by everything I say, but I hope I give them a sense of curiosity and have provoked them to go look this up more and take more of an active interest. You know, I think if I can snap people out of apathy and make them feel like, yes, this matters, and yes, I need to get informed on it, then that'll be enough.
To reduce emissions, get paid, which is great, unless it's only big business capped in charge. That doesn't go far enough. What about tailpipes on cars? That's why some countries go with the carbon tax instead. A flat rate at the source where the fuel gets extracted, and that's when clean energy gets a lot more competitive and revenues get dividends.
That was rap artist Barbara Brinkman in New York talking about his album called A Rap Guide to Climate Chaos. And that wraps up our musical show for this week. To hear more from Living Planet, download the podcast on iTunes or find DW on SoundCloud. Follow us on Twitter at DW_environment or check out our Facebook page, DW Environment. I'm Charlotta Lomas. Thanks for tuning in.